It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock.
Believe me when I say we have a difficult time ahead of us. But if we are to be prepared for it, we must first shed our fear of it. I stand here without fear because I remember. I remember that I am here not because of the path that lies before me, but because of the path that lies behind me. I remember that for 100 years we have fought these machines. And after a century of war, I remember that which matters most. We are still here! Tonight, let us make them remember. We are not afraid!
Welcome back to Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, here in the beautiful studios of Freedoms with an S, freedomsphoenix.com in Phoenix, Arizona. Sitting in studio with me is my good friend Charles Goyette, and I'll tell you, he's taken away a lot of fear for many, 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 many people here in the Valley of the Sun and across the country by just giving them the information that they need to be able to make an informed decision. And, you know, that's one thing. We should talk about this, Charles. Over the years, there's a lot of, Jack Gregson writes for Freedom's Phoenix a lot. Mm-hmm. He was one of the gentlemen that when we're doing your show and so on and, you know, informing the peoples, they go, you know what? I'm going to sell my house in Ahwatukee out here and kind of do it and buy silver.
Good for him.
And I mean, Frank Golubsky used to listen to my show before. And yeah, a lot of Frank. People that, you know, have said, you know, I'm a believer, yeah. And they did it.
Yeah.
Oh, they're appreciative now.
Yeah.
They're coming out okay. Well, let's talk about that a little. I want to get to the war here a little bit because we have some stories up on Freedom's Phoenix where they're talking about the cost of the war. And I remember us talking about this before. We just knew this was coming. And they're saying the $3 trillion war. Now we have all this stuff. But tell the story about you were up-and-coming big Uber guy on Clear Channel, and they said, you know, didn't you get the memo, Charles? You're supposed to be for this thing. You know, tell that story real quick.
I suppose when I die, somebody's going to do a Google search on my name, and they're going to find out about Clear Channel and the war. And everywhere I go, people want to talk about it. And I'm thinking, you know, that was a long time ago. But I don't mind telling a little bit about it. I was a radio talk show host with the big corporation, the 800-pound gorilla of radio talk show corporations. I mean, in every market in the United States, there are maybe one or two big talk stations, and they own at least one of them and sometimes two of them. So anyway, I'm doing really well with these guys, and I've got to, you know, the star spotlights on me, and I'm, you know, I mean, things couldn't be more pleasant in my life, and you know, I'm things are good, and I'm in the star spotlight, and you know, the executives in the corporation that love good talk show hosts love me.
You're on all the taxi cabs around town.
It was good.
You're number one in your slot in the afternoon drive.
And then the Iraq War came out, and I go, wait a minute, let's start at the very beginning. Then we walk through the stuff daily on my show. You know, we walk through the evidence, we walk through the case, we walk through things, little things like the Constitution. I mean, you know, this was conservative right-wing sort of a radio station. And, you know, so you'd think that people after all these years of talking about their devotion to the Constitution would be interested in little thing like Declaration of War. You know, but anyway, we talk about this stuff every day, and it made people really mad. And I was sandwiched between Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity. There's no two bigger warmongers of the broadcast industry than these guys. And I'm right in the middle. I'm going, wait a minute, not so fast. I don't think so. And, you know, I mean, you know, the death threats are
pouring
in.
Get you in the office.
And, of course, Clear Channel Communications, it's a different company now. But at the time, Clear Channel was, the vice chairman of Clear Channel is the guy that made George W. Bush a millionaire. It's the guy that bought his baseball team from him. It's a Texas corporation. They had been supporters of George W. Bush before he even became governor of Texas, much less on his way to the presidency. And so they've got a guy at one of their premium talk stations in a drive time slot telling people, wait a minute, this is all bogus. And they just thought they didn't think that'd be good. So,
well, how did the conversation go, Charles? I mean, they're going, Charles.
Well, let me tell you how the conversation went here. I mean, I can recapture some of them for it. I had an executive senior to me, say, Charles, I always expected you to be a patriot. So that's kind of how the conversation went. And I had the most peculiar thing to this day. This bothers me most out of the whole thing. I have long since it got very, very ugly. And, you know, Howard Stern was talking about me on the radio because I went public with the story. I mean, I knew that, you know, my days with them were numbered. And I got bamboozled in a way that wasn't, you know, really fair. But
well, you did an article in Buchanan's magazine.
The American Conservative.
How to lose your job in talk radio.
That was it, exactly. And so I put it up on the map. I thought, you know, I don't go quietly into the night on this deal. So it became very contentious and... let me back up and say, here's the thing that bothered me most and to this day bothers me about that whole experience is the number of people that would come up to me in the hallway and whisper, Charles, you know, don't tell anybody, but I really agree with you about the war. I had an executive, everybody in the broadcasting industry at any level would know this guy's name if I told you his name. Major player, major corporation, big, big hitter in the talk radio business with my company. Big, you know, seen as high as they go. Called me at home. No, one day I'm talking to him and he says, well, you know, I kind of agree with you about this war and I don't know what you can do. And I, you know, he's commiserating with me. Called me at home later that night. And he said, Charles, just, you know, out of friendship, don't tell anybody that I told you I agree with you about the war because I haven't, nobody around here knows that, you know. But I went through that over and over again many times. I had one of the executives that I worked for at the time that I got squeezed out, and the whole I don't care to really relive the whole process of how it happened. It was very painful, very ugly. You know, death threats for my kids and stuff. It was a really ugly, ugly period. You know, and I was getting Dixie chicked and stuff. I had my own colleagues, you know, people with whom I'd been friendly, you know, worked side by side with for years, you know, saying that I'm anti-American, an obvious terrorist lover and stuff. And it was very very ugly period. But anyway, I one of the executives that was instrumental in the ugliness of the termination called me, I guess, 8 months ago or something and kind of, you know, renewed acquaintances and said, well, you were sure right about the war and so on and so forth. Because it unfolded literally the way I said. And I said it, you know, just like the Vietnam War brought us the stagflation, the high inflation, all the guns and butter policies that we couldn't afford of LBJ and the guns and butter. You know, we're going to have big, big military spending and we're going to have big, welfare spending and stuff. You know, we're going to have new health care plans. Well, they had a new health care plan under LBJ, right? During the war, during the Vietnam War. They have a new health care plan under Barack Obama, right? During the, Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iran war, or whatever it is.
I did Medicare D under Bush.
But it brought us all that that awful economic period of the 1970s, the stagflation, double-digit unemployment, double-digit inflation, double-digit interest rates, just the whole disaster of it. You know, so anyway, I said this whole thing's going to unfold that, you know, oh, you think you're going to have a quick and dirty war. Well, Americans, you're going to learn what karma means because you're not going to have one, and it's going to have a huge impact on you and your lifestyle going forward, and you'll find out in a few years. Anyway, can I finish this when we come
Absolutely,
back?
Absolutely, because we don't want to leave it hanging there. Yeah. You guys stay right there. This is good, good, good history of bad things. We'll be right back here on Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, my special guest, Charles Goyette, author of The Dollar Meltdown, with a new book coming out. We'll talk about that, too.
It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock.
Here in Declare Your Independence of me, Ernest Hancock, in studio, Charles Goyette, about some truth, justice, and what used to be the American way. I mean, you know, Charles, you grew up in, American way, had a definition. It meant something. Somebody was for it. And somebody even defined it, I'll bet you. It was Superman. Yeah. You know, I don't know what it is now. We'll go ahead and finish your story on your adventures with Clear Channel and being against the war, but we have, you know, a study come out, you know, wars... what is the name of it? The $3 trillion war. And it says the authors of the book, The $3 trillion war, noted in a conference call on Wednesday that when they first released their findings 2 years ago, the estimates were widely criticized as being too high. Now the researchers believe that they may have been too low, and they're thinking $4 to $6 trillion. Yeah.
Well, as a matter of fact, that's Joseph Stiglitz. He's a Nobel Prize winning economist, and they came out with the $3 trillion war a couple of years ago. He told me on my radio show, even though he said, yeah, we call it the $3 trillion wars, even a couple of years ago, he said, I think it's going to be more like $5 trillion. You may remember that early on in the planning stages for the war, first of all, there was Paul Wolfowitz. My, he's been quiet lately.
Yeah, we're going to make money.
Paul Wolfowitz, yeah. This is the war that's going to pay for itself, okay? And how's it going to do so? With Iraqi oil. Oh, so that's what we're going to go in there and take the Iraqi oil that belongs to them, and we're going to pay for our war with their oil. But, you know, when they started selling oil deals in Iraq, the very first one wasn't bought by Americans. It was bought by, the very first one was by China. But anyway, there was a guy that was with George Bush when he was governor of Texas in the campaign for presidency. He was an economist by the name of Lawrence Lindsay, Larry Lindsay, and he'd been kind of a Fed official. And, you know, he was moderately sort of a deficit hawk and stuff, but he was still a Fed, big government, paper money, fiat money guy. But, you know, of the insane, he was the one that, you know, you could have a conversation with, you know. So he comes out during the lead up to the war, and instead of, you know, the party line that was fed to us by the neocons in the Bush administration, this war is going to pay for itself. This is the 6-week war like my daddy's. It'll be over and done with at no expense. He said, well, you know, this war, I think his Larry Lindsay's number was $100 billion, $100 billion war. And so they fired him. The guy had, you know, been with Bush all the way through the campaign, been his chief economic guy and stuff. He came out and said the war is going to cost $100 billion. Oh my God, you can't say that, $100 billion. Well, that's nothing. That's chump change. You know, we passed $100 billion, you know, the first couple of months. So anyway, we're looking at a $5 trillion war. And how does Stiglitz get at that, or $6 trillion or more? Well, you have to think about some of the other costs of the war that nobody ever thinks about.
Veterans Administration.
Sure,
is a chunk
you pay
right
for
there.
These guys. You pay for these guys the rest of our lives. You pay for medical care for these guys, psychological care. You pay all kinds. How about the transfer of wealth from the American people? Every time we started saber rattling, the price of oil go up. Well, how'd that affect America? Well, it took money out of the pockets of the American people, and it transferred it to Vladimir Putin's Russia and Hugo Chavez in Venezuela and to Middle East oil sheikhs. You know, and it was untold billions of dollars. Americans were decapitalized by this process. Now, I described it to them at the time it was going on before the bombs started falling. Do you understand how money is being taken out of your pocket because there's a freer premium now on the price of oil? You know, it's, and it depended on the time. You know, it was $10, $20, $30. I saw it at times. I thought it was $30, $40 a barrel, higher than it should be just because of Bush's saber rattling. And it was just, it was a wealth transfer. You know, it was great for the Saudi oil sheikhs. It wasn't so great for the American people. But it took years for the American people to kind of realize where they are, you know. And now the chickens have come home to roost economically. That's only the beginning. There are all kinds of costs. There were costs to brand name America overseas. You know, there were people all over the world thought America is a force for disruption in the world. We don't want American companies coming around here. People didn't want to buy American goods. There are all kinds of financial impacts of that war. Stiglitz didn't even count them all. I don't think he counted them all, but at least he tried to estimate them more honestly than the government did. Anyway, all of this stuff that we're going through now was triggered. Just as the Vietnam War triggered the mess of the 70s, this war will go down in history, the Iraq War will go down in history as having triggered this entire debacle that we were in. It's the event that exposed all the malinvestment. The malinvestments were going to get exposed. They're going to have to be assimilated and rationalized somehow. But it was this event that was the trigger. It was this war that all of a sudden started changing everything, decapitalizing the American people, changing, brand name America around the world, and so on and so forth. Anyway, but I wanted to say about my own experience is the people that made my life a living hell for a period of 6 months or so, or a year, really, it was closer to a year, in opposing to this war before they thought I'd slink away and disappear, I have long since forgiven them. You know, You know, I believe that they were foolish. Many of them have told me so, that they believe they were too. They wish we hadn't done it. But, you know, it doesn't matter because all kinds of people, you know, are conditioned in life to believe what the government tells them and so on. But where's the real problem? Where's the criminality? There's foolishness. Foolishness isn't criminal. You know, believing what you're told by somebody isn't criminal. Yes, it's negligence on their part. I've forgiven all of them. I've totally forgiven, because there is no reason to think that broadcasting executives are smarter than the general run of the mill of the American public. In fact, you look at the state of broadcasting in America, they may be dumber, right? You look at the crap that they put out on the airwaves of radio and television, they may be worse off than the average run-of-the-mill of the American people. So I don't hold them to a higher standard, but what about the people that conscientiously lied to us? What about the people that were in the White House Iraq group? What about the people that marketed this war like a brand of soap? What about the people that came together and fabricated the evidence? What about the people that, ladies and gentlemen of America, if there's one takeaway from this war, it is this. Somebody wanted war badly enough to forge documents and put them in the American chain. And they worked their way all the way up to the President of the United States and the State of the Union address. Somebody wanted war really badly to forge documents, to cook up, phony defectors with phony intelligence, to load them down with phony intelligence that a trained professional could have seen through in a second. Somebody really, really, really wanted war. And we were talking about constituencies for this economic calamity. There were constituencies for the war. There were Karl Rove. Karl Rove wanted the war because he thought it would get him the midterm elections in 2004. The Democrats would be afraid to oppose the Republicans, and they'd waltz to victory. And they did. And there were people I watched, Kudlow. I watched Larry Kudlow effectively want the war because he thought it would be good for the stock market. I watched, I think it was William Seedman, used to be a FDIC official, used to be a guy at Arizona State University, nationally known business school economist, and it was, I think, head of the FDIC for a while. I watched him say that he thought the war would be good for the economy. It hasn't turned out that way. So there were people that thought the war would be great for Israel. It's not going to turn out that way. There are people that thought it would be great for all kinds of different reasons, and they all came together.
Well, these people that you associated with in the industry, and you know, a lot of them I know, I'm wondering, did they ever seek out your forgiveness? I mean, did they actively, some kind of a
as much as you can expect? Some of them never heard from, There are a couple of them that have just said something sheepish, I sure got that one wrong, and I don't expect.
Well, there's no compensation coming back to the people that they lied to and people that lied. You know, that's one thing. You know, I've told this before. You know, you're good friends with Steve Benson, the cartoonist over at the Arizona Republic, and you know, he and I get into it every time we're at some party or doing the whatever. And the one thing that I wanted to impress upon him at one party is, I go, Steve, you know, if everybody believed everything that your newspaper said, they're worth 20% of what their value was. You know, they know you lied about the war. They know you lied about the economy. They know you lied about housing. They know you lied. And you're thinking they're going to keep subscribing to you? Why would you think that? You know, so these guys, I'm wondering, the lamestream media, the media that's so last century, is getting replaced. Well, it's time for Charles to make his way back into, make it the mainstream again.
There are those that just want to be left alone, and those that just won't leave them alone. Which one are you? The Ernest Hancock Show.
Turn on the tube. What do I see? A whole lot of people crying. Don't blame me. They point their crooked little fingers at everybody else. Spend all the time feeling sorry for themselves. Think them of this, think them of that. Your mama's too thin and you're getting too fat. Get over it.
Yeah, you better get over it. You got to take care of yourself. You can whine and complain all you want, and you know what? Nobody's going to feed you. You have to do it. You got chickens. I mean, you need to get a garden, some chickens, and some silver. I mean, that's just the way it is. You know, we're in studio with Charles Goyette. Now, he's been a top of the line talk show host for a long time. And there's for like 2.5 year period, I was his producer. And we.
Those were the good old days.
Good old days. I was senior imperial producer. Yeah. You know, I wanted the title. And we had a lot of fun, and it was during very bad times.
It was dark.
And if it wasn't for us just, you know, maintaining our own sanity by, you know, getting this stuff out, venting, you know, a lot of great guests, a lot of people, because there weren't a lot of places these people could relay what they knew. I mean, we had great shows, great experts, great, and a lot of them we've brought onto this show. So a lot of people know what's going on. They listen to our shows. They know what's happening, and it makes it a little bit easier. And then I read your book, The Dollar Meltdown, and I go, I remember this.
Yeah.
You know, it's going through a lot of this stuff, and it's done so well. It's been translated into Chinese.
Yeah.
It's translated into Korean.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Chinese want this book. They're
like,
yeah, we want to understand what the heck, you know, how we're getting screwed here. So they're holding it up as they're meeting with Hillary, saying, yeah, no, Charles already explained it to us. Nice try. So this is, you know, you're having a major impact on that. And you were so well known for being against the war on a lot of principled, principled reasons. But all of a sudden now you come out with a book on the economy, and your background, you used to be dealing in gold and stocks and everything. You had a financial background before. And then so this comes out. Then you got this did so well and coming out in paperback. Now your publisher goes,
what's the next book?
Yeah, you got to make us some more money, man. You know, so we'll do that. And then we'll get to that. But this is one thing I want to get this all out, because we'll turn you on, man. You just go. But I want to get all this stuff out. When the Ron Paul Revolution started, by that time, I couldn't be a producer anymore because Freedom's Phoenix really took off, and I needed to spend time on that and went that way. But Charles and I were still good friends and so on, and I go, this Ron Paul thing, you watch what happens. I go, you just watch. You know, I just, you know, here comes the revolution. You just watch what happens. Yeah. I'm going, yeah, you just wait. It won't take very long. And it exploded. Well, you're on Fox News one night.
No, it was CNN.
No, it was Fox.
Yeah, it was Fox.
You're on Fox News, and of course, you took the opportunity. You were the first person on national television to mention Ron Paul running for president or thinking about it.
Yeah.
And when you did that, you know, how do we get this up? That was my first YouTube.
Yeah, yeah.
I cracked the thing on your DVR, kind of get it, whatever. The first YouTube anybody had done about anything Ron Paul, everything, was Charles Goyette on Fox News.
Wow, yeah.
And I put that up, and it went stupid.
Yeah.
It still is very popular.
It's still out there, yeah.
Yeah, it's just rocking and rolling.
Yeah.
So this is how Charles and I know each other. Because when you were going up against the war, I mean, that was a much braver thing, position from where you were at. I was on the radio. I was the morning show at another station at the time when the war was getting ready to go up. I had Tony Snow on before he became press secretary, and I'll just hammer on him because he used to be assistant communications director under Daddy Bush, and you know, he didn't want that to be out. So I go, Mr. Snow, well, obviously you have an opinion about this war. You're going on Fox News Sunday and create this whole thing. Well, I would imagine you'd have an opinion, seeing as how you were, you know, kind of directing the first one with Daddy Bush, you know. Hey, man, you know, we didn't approve that. You know, we don't want to talk about that one. So the thing is that, yeah, I was hammered against this war too. And it was, but Charles, man, he was out there getting all this attention. When you came out with the Dollar Meltdown, people had associated you with being anti-war. You know, it was amazing to me. You got a big publisher to take this on, and it was so popular. And where did your experience, where did that side of you come from?
But, you know, I had a chance to break out of the war thing a little bit. I started, there was a period like in about 2000, and I'm not sure when, 2006 and 7, when I'd go on CNN once every 2 weeks to just talk about
Lou Dobbs,
to just talk about things going on in politics. But I mean, I thought I'd pretty much confine myself to the war thing until I had an idea that the American people had awakened. You know, I thought that, I'm a small, still voice. I had a tiny, tiny, tiny part of the conversation in a tiny, tiny part of the world. But I thought, I'm going to stay on this thing. I'm going to be like the dog that worries the bone until the American people have awakened. And Bush got reelected in 2004. And I thought, well, the American people haven't awakened. And then in 2006, the Congress went Democratic. And it was, no matter what Ann Coulter may tell you, it was because the people had enough of the friggin' war. They had enough of the lies. They had enough of the war. Everybody realized that. No WMDs.
Of course, they didn't fix anything. Yeah, but that was why
Fix anything. But anyway, so they thought, well, change of. So I thought, okay, the people started got it. I can get off of the war issue a little bit and start talking more about things like the economy. But I've been, the economy had been one of my primary interests all of my life. I mean, people don't remember this. I had almost a generation ago. Now I'm starting to date myself. Let me think. I had in the early 1980s, I had monetary conferences that I put on with all kinds of dignitaries in California, Newport Beach, and here in Arizona and stuff. And I was all over the country talking about the economy and things like that. I put on these big monetary conferences with keynote speakers like Dr. Murray Rothbard and Ron Paul. People, what? Ron Paul in the 80s? Yeah, Ron Paul in the 1980s. And Ron Paul in the 1980s could have looked you in the eye and told you exactly where this thing was going to unfold, when it was going to unfold, just exactly like it's done. So, I was happy out of my mind when Ron Paul, said, yeah, okay, so maybe I'll make the sacrifice. I think it's a sacrifice for anybody of principle to run, because you're going to get confronted by morons like George Stephanopoulos. you can't win. You mean they pay him $8 million a year to be a political genius to come up and go, hey, I'm an advanced political analyst and I handicap these things. You're not going to win, don't you? That's what he gets the big money for. I mean, what is this?
Yeah,
It's utterly amazing. So anyway, but I remember getting invited down to Fox to talk about something. It was some stupid concert in the Capitol. It was an Al Gore concert, and somebody wanted to make a big thing. Look, here's how these things work. You're going to have a concert in a public place. You got to put up bond money. You got to, there's going to be, somebody's going to pick up the trash because rock and rollers leave trash behind, duh. And somebody's, police protection because the cop's going to want to stop kids from smoking marijuana, right? So if you're going to have a concert on the steps of the Capitol, right, or on the mall or something, somebody's got to put up the money. So anyway, Fox was making this thing about, whoa, they're going to have a rock and roll concert in Washington. I'm thinking, yeah, they have marches, they have demonstrations, Glenn Beck's has stuff, they have all kinds of things. What's the big deal? These right-wing guys are making a big deal about they're going to have a rock and roll concert. Oh, it's terrible, and the taxpayers are going to pay for it. No, they're not. Taxpayers don't pay for that. The guy that puts on the concert has to put up the money clip. So anyway, so I go, yeah, I'll come on the show. So I'm driving down the studio to talk about, what's the big deal? It's a rock concert. Why are we focused on this? You got a war going on that's killing people by the tens of thousands. Yet you had millions of Americans or of Iraqis homeless. You had the death toll of Americans going up higher and higher and higher. I used to post it on my website. I finally quit. It was going so high. And in the face of all this, all they want to talk about was we're going to have a rock concert. Somebody's going to have a rock. Oh, how terrible. Somebody's going to have a rock concert. So I go down and think, I'm driving down to the studio to do the Fox show, and I think, how can I get in about Ron Paul's presidential candidacy? It has nothing to do with a rock concert. How can I get that in this discussion? And lo and behold, we come to the end of the little segment, and I'm on with Mike Gallagher. He's a nationally syndicated talk show host and a Fox contributor. And he's going, hey, Charles, are taxpayers going to pay for that? And I'm going, I got to get this in there. I got to get something in there about Ron. I got to get something in there. And so finally, you can see this. The host is trying to wrap the segment up, all the signals, right? He's out of time. He's got a producer telling him you're 30 seconds late. And finally I just go on automatic and I blah, 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 Ron Paul and these guys, that guy's Ron Paul, Ron Paul, Ron Paul, Ron Paul, and they're kind of looking at me and they don't know where's this coming from out of the clear blue.
No, I mean, you said if anyone knows anything about the calamity that's coming, the certain economy, the blah blah blah, would be Congressman Ron Paul running for. And the fact that you even mentioned that,
it was great.
They didn't like that none too much.
I walked out of there. I was so happy. I thought, I was so happy. I have no interest in, putting on a tie and driving down to a studio to be on Fox News for 5 minutes. unless I can, you know, talk about a rock concert. But if I could get something in about Ron Paul, howdy.
Did you ever get back on Fox since then?
Yeah, many times. I've been on, this month, I've been on Fox like two times this month.
Oh, now they're coming around.
I hope so.
They're going, no. They all they want is to, I don't know, try not to be in the front line of the guillotine line. No, we had Charles on. Don't kill us. We'll be right back here on Declare Your Independence in just a little bit.
And now, live from the studios of Freedom's Phoenix, Ernest Hancock.
Welcome back to Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, my guest, my special guest, good friend Charles Goya in studio. You know, you got to real quick before we go, man, yeah. You got to tell me about your new book, what it's going to be about.
Yeah, I'm glad you asked about that because, you know, it's like, what is the value in saying I told you so, right? There's no value in saying so. I'm writing a new book about the relationship between freedom and prosperity. And it shouldn't really be a surprise to anybody that, you know, freedom and prosperity kind of go hand in hand. You can find some cases where people are kind of slaves and they're still more or less prosperous. And you can find some cases where people are free and they're not terribly prosperous. But if you want to find just a really, really strong correlation, it's almost always dependable as a degree of freedom. I'll give you an example. Jim Rogers. You remember Jim?
Billionaire biker.
Billionaire biker, investment biker. And he wrote about when he was traveling around the world on his motorcycle and going into country after country after country. I think he started making a game out of it. He said he could tell at the border how prosperous the people would be, how good the economy would be, what kind of opportunities there would be in a country before he went into the country, judging by the amount of bureaucracy at the border. You know, you have a hardtop convertible on your car that's going to be shipped in. Well, you can't ship. You know, you've got to ask the man for permission to ship. You know, you got the paperwork, the bureaucracy, the phony paper, the funny money. You know, they want to exchange the currencies, all of these things. They have phony currencies, all these things. He said, I think he said it kind of became like a game. He could tell exactly how prosperous they would be before he ever went into a country. You know, out of 200 countries on the earth, I think he visited 180 of them or something, just by the bureaucracy at the borders. So this is the sort of thing I'm writing about, and I think I'm going to take the attitude and the final edit of it is the evidence seems to me fairly clear that the American people don't want to be prosperous. You know, they continue to buy into policies and politicians that will make us more poor. So it seems to be very clear that the American people don't want to be prosperous, and that's fine if that's your decision. You don't want your kids to be prosperous. That, you know, lack of prosperity means diminished opportunities, so you want fewer opportunities for yourself. You want fewer opportunities for your family, for your kids. You don't want to be, that's fine, but you know, you should at least make sure you know that you're entering into this contract knowingly. Right, you should know what the. So I'm taking the attitude that if suddenly you did decide that you wanted to be prosperous, here are some of the things that you need to do.
So that's what the book's going to be.
That's basically how we restore America's prosperity. But I'm not going out there bludgeoning anybody because, you know, I understand.
Do you have to vote?
No, I understand that socialism is waxing and freedom is waning in America.
You know, see, this is where you and I have always kind of diverged a little bit. I really have a lot more faith in the people. I just don't have any faith in how their opinions are represented. I don't think the media tells the truth. I don't think computer balloting tells the truth.
I don't
think congressmen and politicians tell the truth. I don't think CEOs and corporations that benefit from the government tell the truth.
I completely agree. But look, when the people finally have enough, and you know, to me, the seminal event, the straw that broke the camel's back on the economic flim-flam that was going on, was Bush's $700 billion bailout. Oh, the people were crazy. You know, everybody knew it was one of the most grotesque wealth transfers from the people to the moneyed classes in history. I mean, this was a monumental wealth transfer. It was a rip-off of gigantic proportions,
that's
right?
Still going on, and they aren't done yet.
Yeah, I know. But the people got it. You know, they smelled the stench of death in that thing. And so, you know, it was like, you know, calls into Congress and stuff were running, you know, 99-1 against it. Don't do this. Don't vote for this. And I'm thinking, okay, you know, this is the sort of thing it's getting the people's attention, right?
No, I remember what they were saying. 99-1 The one, you know, was the no, and was 99 what? Was hell no.
Yeah. Yeah. No, the one was the guy that was going to get the money. He called it too. No, go ahead and vote for that. So anyway, so I'm watching. I'm thinking, this is a good thing. Here's a chance for the American people to grab hold of the system now, to, you know, get an idea, grab hold of their own futures. Don't let these people plunder them. Don't let them steal from their left pocket and their right pocket and their front pocket and their back pocket at the same time. So then, you know, so bubbling up in response to that, you have the Tea Parties. You know, the Tea Party started with Ron Paul, and, you know, one of the guys on CNBC started one in Chicago. You know, you people got to, you know, you stop this bailouts. So the people came together. They understood something was wrong. But I watched the big Tea Party movement in response to it here in Phoenix. And who did they have as one of their primary speakers? A congressman who had voted for the bailout.
No, that brought it back.
Yeah.
Chaddick. He's the one that brought it back.
Yeah, sure. He voted for it.
It went down.
But here, no, I don't care. It does, all the other details about it don't matter. But the people, the Tea Party people, the organizer of the Tea Party and the attendees they should have hung him in effigy. Right? But they had him speak. And this has gone on all over the country. And these neocons that are bankrupt, they've taken the Tea Party movement over. So you had, you know, the people, you talk about the people have the right instinct and, you know, freedom, and they're not going to be bamboozled. And I'm watching, yeah, okay, well, so they get, you know, they get reamed, and they don't like it, and it doesn't feel good. So they do wake up, but then they lurch around and they stumble into incompetent, bad leadership. How can they have Shadegg speak at the Tea Party movement?
Because
it's symbolic of the way stuff works.
It was Clear Channel and Fox. They got the stage and the microphone, and they go, here, we're going to have our boys. Yeah. I spoke right after Shadegg, and right after me was J.D. Hayworth. You know, and he's up there going, that ran against McCain. Yeah. Oh, my good friend Ernie, blah, 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 blah. And the first thing out of my mouth, I go, hey, I'm not with any of these guys. I'm like, and then what happened? Andrea Garcia, that's running against Russell Pierce, Mr. SB 1070, she was standing 10 feet right in front of Shadegg with that big sign that we had, National Socialization of the Economy Isn't Fascist, ... when I do it, John S.S. Shadegg. You know, so, and what happened? The crowd, man, they're going to lynch her because she would dare impugn him.
Sure.
And then she goes, you brought it, you voted for the TARP, you brought it. He goes, on the microphone, he's going, I don't know what you're talking about. That's not true. I mean, yeah, she says this. So part of my speech was, I go, do you think that these young revolutionaries don't have videotape of what you just said and what you just did a few months ago? You think that's not going to come out in the 2010 midterm elections? What did he do? He pulled from the race because he knew I was going to brand his butt. But the Tea Party and these, they have orchestrated this in such a way that they have, kind of done the demographic of the older, kind of retired American patriot, Fox News watching people, and the millions that went to Washington that time that had all the We Support Ron Paul and all the issues and in the Fed and all that, they were excommunicated. They were not supported. They were not encouraged. And you are left with the same people that guys like Tom Jenny and Americans for Prosperity all the Republican guys are doing it.
You make my point for me then. So the same guys, the same governing classes stay in charge, and, you know, they will be the caretakers of the corpse as long as it takes for the corpse to collapse.
Yeah.
So there you go.
And then it's going to collapse, and we're going to. Well, you know, this is what we got to look forward to. I mean, I had Salente on, Gerald Salente, man. He's like, you know, running blood in the streets kind of guy.
Yeah.
I mean, what are you thinking?
Well, I mean, I think he's right.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
No, it's these things aren't pleasant. I try in the Dollar Meltdown to walk people through these things because these currency crises are not pleasant events. And there's a whole spectrum that I describe in there of how ugly they can be. They can really be French Revolution, Reign of Terror ugly. You know, you can have other kinds. You know, we had a currency crisis and destruction of the continental currency. But, you know, we were a young country of independent people at the time. So it was different.
No, you know? Hamilton went and bought them all up, got the Constitution made bank.
Yeah. made money.
Well,
on
let's
the deal.
Talk about, before we run out of time, I want to talk about the this resurrection of the Ron Paul Revolution.
Yeah, tell me.
You know, I don't know. I've been getting a lot of calls. I mean, November 5th, which is, I guess, the Friday right after the election. You know, I thought it was right before, but it's right after the election. And they want, go get your dust off your Ron Paul signs and put them up, and woohoo, and we're going to do it again.
Great.
So I'm going, okay, you know, a lot of people have been contacted, want to get access to the artwork, and what am I going to do, and yada, yada, yada. And I, my kind of open comment to Dr. Paul is, you know, cool, do it, but I'll tell you, you know, as many young people learn from that experience, that government and voting and whatever is not what's going to make them free. I'm going to emphasize that even more this time. I'm like, look, you know, yeah, I'm glad you're out there and educating the people and we understand what's going on. But this next generation, if you think voting is going to make you free, you have not been paying attention. So I'm going, you know, from your perspective, how do you think the next 2 years is going to play out as everything that he said was going to happen is happening right before our eyes?
Yeah, I don't know. I hope he makes the run only because he's a good focal point. You know, he's earned a great deal of credibility. People will pay attention to him. He's set armies of young people marching. He's gotten, you know, I remember talking with Congressman Paul back in the 80s and coming up with an idea. Let's form this thing, the Committee to Abolish the Fed. And he goes, yeah. And I go, yeah, we'll start the Committee to Abolish the Fed. But, you know, he was busy. And I was busy, and we never did it, but it didn't matter because it would never have taken off. Today, you could actually do something like that because, you know, thanks to him and his campaign and thanks to the, you know, economic debacle that they've marched us into here, you know, people are paying attention to that kind of stuff. So I hope he runs. More power to him. I'll be in his corner. You bet.
Do you think the Republican Party will give him a little bit more respect this time?
Yeah, they have to. Not willingly, but grudgingly. They have to. Because, you know, they you know, these politicians, where are we going to get money? Well, look what the Ron Paul money was. Where are we going to get young people? We got to get young people. Look at the Ron Paul campaign. That's just what they don't want to hear, though, because they want to hold on to their governing authority.
Yeah, you know, I'm of the opinion, Neil, you think they should. You think they would. You think it's inevitable. I don't see him doing it. I see he's kryptonite, and they're freaking out. So we'll see what happens. Time will tell. Well, thanks for coming in, Charles. It's always great to spend time with you. So we'll be right back for the final hour here on Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, and just a little bit. You stay right there.